This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The photographer known as Ouija was often the first photographer at the scene of New York fires, murders, and mayhem. But he was also on the beach and at the opera, capturing the diversity of daily life in New York. His pictures of New York in the 30s and 40s were published in tabloids and magazines. Now he ranks as one of the most eccentric and celebrated news photographers of his time. You can see Ouija's photos and read about his life in the book Ouija's World by my guest Miles Barth. It just won the Best Photographic History Book Award from the American Photographic Society. Barth also curated the recent exhibit of Ouija's work at the International Center of Photography in New York. The show will tour Europe next fall and America in the year 2000. Ouija died in 1968 at the age of 69. In a few minutes, we'll hear a recording of him discussing his work. I asked Miles Barth to describe one of Ouija's most famous photos.
Well, I think his most famous photograph, although it is not necessarily my favorite, it's certainly his most reproduced photograph, and it's an image of two elderly opera patrons entering the Metropolitan Opera on the evening of November 22nd, 1943, for the 50th anniversary of the Metropolitan Opera here in New York. And on the extreme right of the photograph is what we, I guess, would call now a bag woman that Ouija had strategically placed on the edge of the photograph. And the image depicts the two women dressed in furs and jewels coming into the opera with this bag woman looking on from the right, and it was really Ouija's kind of take on the differences in the class struggle that was existing in New York, the difference between the rich and the poor and the well-dressed and the haves and the have-nots. That photograph, Ouija had staged. He had planned the photograph, not necessarily with the two women who were the opera patrons, but he had brought the woman from the Bowery at about 4 p.m. and placed her in the back seat of his car and got her completely drunk and asked his assistant, who relayed this story to me, to stand at the curb and hold the woman up as best as possible. And when the first limousine was to pull up with the first patrons arriving that evening, he was to let go of the woman and Ouija was to make his famous photograph. Unfortunately, none of the daily newspapers published the photograph. He could not find a buyer until Life magazine published it about 2 weeks later. And it was published very small in the lower left-hand corner of a larger article about the 50th anniversary of the Metropolitan Opera. The reason, it turns out, that it was not published by any of the daily newspapers, there were two important reasons. One, it was wartime, and the newspapers were very afraid to show women dressed in jewels and furs while American servicemen were overseas fighting, you know, protecting our country's honor. And the other reason was, it turns out, by chance, that one of the two women in the photograph who walked out of the limousine was a Mrs. George Washington Cavanaugh, who was the major patron of the opera for their 50th anniversary. She was known to everyone in New York at the time, and the newspapers were so frightened that if they were to run this photograph of her, there would be a major reaction from both the opera and from, you know, New York society. So it never really ran in a New York newspaper, but it turns out it's probably Ouija's most famous photograph.
It's a great story. One of Ouija's subjects was dead bodies. I mean, Ouija took photos of corpses with bloodied faces and pools of blood around the body. He has a 1941 picture of a guy in a pool of blood with a dead-on-arrival ticket on his arm. Mm-hmm. There's a picture called Murder on the Roof in which the cops are going through the corpse's pockets. A 1942 photo called Gunman Killed by Off-Duty Cop at Broom Street. And the gunman is lying on his stomach, his face covered with blood, his gun by his side. Now, you know, in relation to these photos, you said the New York Times hardly printed any of his stuff. Ouija wrote, he disagreed with the New York Times editorial policy of not running pictures of local dead gangsters, no matter how prominent. I love that, no matter how prominent. Mm-hmm. Even the famous dead people, they wouldn't print. What were the standards of newspapers at that time in terms of printing blood or printing corpses?
Well, I think it depended on the newspaper, but certainly the New York Daily News and the Post, the Journal American, the Herald Tribune, they weren't afraid of it. It sold newspapers. And Ouija had a very interesting relationship with one newspaper in particular called PM. He was not on staff, and he was never on staff of any newspaper, but PM gave him a $100 a week stipend, and in return for that, they were offered the first photos of Ouija's nightly catch or early morning catch. And whatever they didn't use or whatever they refused, Ouija had the right to go on and sell to other newspapers. And PM was relatively gentle when it came to the crime photos. So Ouija found a much better market at the Daily News and at the New York Post. And the photographs or the style of the newspapers at that time, I believe it was that, you know, it was wartime for the most part, and certainly between 1936 and 1945, Ouija's heyday, the newspapers were not afraid to run that kind of photograph. It sold newspapers. I think by comparison, today's newspapers are really quite bland. You rarely see dead bodies in the newspapers, and I think the television has really taken over a lot of that kind of more sensational visual news. But Ouija, besides the photographs of dead bodies, which he did become famous for, he prided himself also on the human interest stories, the people who were watching the crimes, the people who were affected by the crimes and the fires and the tragedies, the auto accidents, whatever it might be. He was always turning around to the crowd. He was not just focused on the event. And what you'll see repeatedly in his photographs, even of the dead corpses on the ground, many times he's just as interested in the crowd that's gathered around. The photo you mentioned of the people on the rooftop, it's certainly, I think, the way Ouija has positioned the angle of the photo, the camera, to make that image, he's as concerned with the viewers as he is with the dead body and the police gathered around the body taking fingerprints and doing various police tasks. It's a repeated theme in his work that he was extremely concerned with documenting human emotion.
Ouija prided himself on getting to the scene of the crime and often getting there first. What were his techniques for knowing where the scene of the crime was?
Well, it wasn't a technique. It was a very specific kind of event that took place. In 1938, he was the first photographer ever to be granted a permit from the New York City Police Department to install a radio receiving unit in his car, which was capable of capturing the shortwave broadcasts of the police and fire departments. And it was really, for about 2 or 3 years, he had this edge on the competition. I think Walter Winchell was the first person in New York, first civilian ever to receive that same honor. But Ouija was certainly the first photographer. And as a freelance photographer, and in and of itself, that was quite rare at the time because most of the other newspaper and most of the other photographers were attached to newspapers or publications or the syndication services. Ouija was completely alone, and he depended on, you know, making a photograph at night that he could sell to a newspaper the next morning, and he did live from night to morning and morning to night. So the ability to be able to arrive at the scene of a crime or an auto accident or a fire or any kind of disaster where one of the city agencies was involved was really to his advantage.
Were there a lot of photographers before him who specialized in being at the crime scene? You know,
there were other photographers, certainly, who did crime photographs. I think what made Ouija interesting was his mobility. The fact that he was using a large format but relatively portable camera, something that had a synchronized flash. He had a 1938 Chevy that was equipped. Its trunk was really a portable office. He would type his own captions. He always had about 100 cigars and 100 flashbulbs ready at any one time. He was out there. He was a one-man kind of photo agency, photo syndication service, and he knew all the photo editors of all the New York City daily newspapers and was able to sell photographs to a lot of them. It's been said that in a single week he could make up to $150 to $200, you know, in terms of salary, which was an enormous amount of money at that time.
My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan and author of the book Ouija's World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan and author of a book about the photographer known as Ouija. Miles, you've brought something special with you for us to hear, and that is a tape of Ouija talking about his work and how he does it. And this is very interesting to listen to. Tell us about where the tape is from and how you managed to get it.
a number of years ago, in one of the collections we have, I discovered this 33 and a third long playing record album called Famous Photographers Tell How. And it was a recording of nine different photographers from almost nine different disciplines of photography talking about what made them successful or how you too could be a famous photographer. And Ouija, at the time, 1958, was quite well known in the field of photojournalism and documentary photography, and I think the producers of this record just felt that he was such a character, he would lend an enormous amount of taste and color to the recording. So that's what you're going to be listening to.
Well, let's hear Ouija talking about his work.
I will walk many times with friends down the street, and they'll say, "Hey, Ouija, here's a drunk or two drunks laying on the gutter." I take one quick look at them. I say, they lack character. So even a drunk must be a masterpiece. I will ride around all night or all year looking for a good drunk picture. One of the most beautiful ones I got after riding around 2 years, then I made my drunk picture, was a guy in Amsterdam Avenue. One Sunday morning, about 5 o'clock, he was sleeping underneath a canopy of a funeral undertaking parlor. Now that to me was a picture. Of course, the obvious title would be Dead Drunk. So, in other words, I am a perfectionist. When I take a picture, if it's a murder or if it's a drunk, it's got to be good. When a person gets in trouble and they get arrested, the first thing they do, they cover up their faces. And editors don't like it. They say, don't give me any excuses. Give me a picture so our readers can see what the person looks like. For example, the New York cops arrested a woman who was wanted for a $25,000 jewel robbery in Washington, D.C. The woman, being a dope, was naturally captured. She was in a cell downstairs in the basement of Manhattan Police Headquarters. I went down, she started to cover up. I says, look, lady, save your energy. I'm not going to take a picture. All I want to do is talk with you. She says, now, I know what you want. You want to take my picture. Why should I let you? So my friends, relatives, and mother can see it on the front pages of the newspapers. I said, now, wait a minute, lady. Don't be so hasty. You have your choice. Do you want your picture to appear in the papers, a Rose Gallery picture with your number underneath it? Or would you let me make a nice home portrait study of you using nice, soft lighting like Rampant would have done? Talking and arguing with her, I convinced her that that was the only logical thing for her to do, to pose for a picture. Now, that was a good catch, you might say, for me, besides the New York cops. Anyway, this showed that by arguing with people, you can get them to uncover. People are reasonable, even jewel thieves.
That's Ouija, recorded in 1958. My guest, Miles Barth, is the author of the book Ouija's World. You can tell from that tape that, you know, Ouija really thought of himself as having a mission.
He was possessed. He was possessed at a certain period of his life. I think, you know, what's interesting for most people to find out about Ouija is that his working career was actually quite short, basically from 1936 to the publication of his book Naked City in 1945. And I think when he's compared to some of his contemporaries, whether it be Robert Capa, who had an almost 35-year career, or Henri Cartier-Bresson, or a number of photographers who would have been his contemporaries, not necessarily people he knew of, but his contemporaries. It's a very, very short period of time that he had a working career. And I think for those 9 or 10 years, he was on the streets almost 7 days a week, from 10 at night until 5 in the morning.
Do you think it's fair to say that he had an impact on tabloid photography that came after him?
I think he did. I think he had an impact on it, but it's interesting how technology changed so much during the 1950s that a lot of his photographs and a lot of his technique was really forgotten about when photography switched to the larger format 4x5 cameras, to the more portable 2.25 and then 35mm cameras. I also think, you know, by the late 50s, certainly by the early 60s, that television had replaced so much of the outlet for where photographers could market their photographs that unless they were attached to a syndication or to a magazine or newspaper, there were very few freelance photographers who could make a go of it. I think his influence was was really quite extraordinary, but how much that carried over into the sort of next two generations, it's really hard to know.
The most famous tabloid photographers today are the paparazzi, who are often freelancers and often camping out in the bushes waiting for the celebrity to walk out the door, or, you know, hiding behind a building waiting for an embarrassing celebrity moment, or, you know, if they're really lucky, some kind of devastating tragedy that they'll be on the spot to cover. Do you think that Ouija has any connection to that? And was he thought in that was he thought of as a parasite in his time, in the way that a lot of paparazzi are thought of as parasites today?
I'm asked that question a lot because of obviously of recent events where paparazzi have been called into the light of the press and just criticism in general. But you know, Ouija was really making a living doing photographs, not necessarily of celebrities. The work he did of celebrities takes place much later in his life, and I think the work we associate with his important period was not so much about chasing a particular celebrity or a particular event where celebrities might have shown up. If you look in the book and in the exhibition, really a very, very, very small part of it is about people we know of. They were famous at the day for the crimes they might have committed, or they might have been famous for the rescues that they'd performed, but they certainly were not personalities in the same way we would define, you know, radio and showbiz personalities today, or even movie personalities who are being chased constantly. And I'm not sure that Ouija's, you know, relationship to contemporary day paparazzi is really a true one. I'm a bit, in fact, disturbed by when people say that he was the father of paparazzi, because the term paparazzi really comes out of Italy in the 1950s and long after Ouija was finished doing any kind of chasing around after photographs. And the personality photographs that appear in the book and exhibition were really done knowingly by the people who were in the photographs. They were there as photo opportunities, and Ouija was one of many photographers who made those photographs. So I don't like to consider him in the same light as contemporary day paparazzi or, you know, stalkers.
After 1945, he basically left the newspaper world, went out to Los Angeles hoping to make it in movies. Did he have any luck?
He did. He had a little luck. He was in small bit parts in six different films.
So he wanted to act, not be a cinematographer.
Well, I think he wanted to do both. I think he wanted to do anything where he could get inside the kind of Hollywood scene, whether it meant being an actor or being a technical consultant. He did both. Not with a lot of regularity, and I think there were very lean periods in between, you know, when he was working. And it was at that time, and during those lean times and idle hours, that he started to develop the work that we call distortions, the work he did almost for the last 20 years of his life, where he manipulated images using cameras and lenses and kaleidoscopes and various pieces of glass and plastic to distort straight images. And this is really what grew out of his Hollywood period. In 1952, Ouija came back to New York from Hollywood. He was not really accepted in Hollywood society, and I think he found both the people in Hollywood, as he described them, zombies, and really missed New York. I think he missed the action of just being in the city and came back, but he did not pick up his large format camera ever again. He, in fact, hawked it before he came back to New York. And he started working with small format cameras and medium format cameras, creating and continuing his series of distortions, which he made by either placing plastic or glass in front of the lens of a camera or the lens of an enlarger. He would also attach a kaleidoscope to a camera instead of a lens and photograph right through the kaleidoscope to create very distorted kaleidoscope-looking images. And as he tried to peddle these things to the magazines, they were constantly asking him, well, why not just go back on the streets and do your photojournalism and be the Ouija of old? And he said, well, there is no Ouija of old. This is Ouija the artist speaking, and this is my calling, and this is what I plan to do for the rest of my life, which, in fact, is what he did for the rest of his life.
For my money, I found Ouija the tabloid photographer more of the artist than Ouija the artist.
Well, I think a lot of people do, and I think what happened was in 1945-46, Ouija just got completely overwhelmed, superstaturated to just human misery, basically. He was an extremely sensitive person. Arthur Fellig was sensitive, not Ouija. But Arthur Fellig, I think, had absorbed as many murders and as many kind of victims of fire and crime as he could possibly absorb and record.
Arthur Fellig was the real name of Ouija.
Correct. And I think he just decided when he was in Hollywood and when he came back from Hollywood, back to New York, that he was not going to pick up a camera and document any kind of misery anymore, and that he was going to create this new form of art photography, which I think I was saying the photo editors rarely picked up on. He had much more success with that work in Europe than he did in this country.
My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in New York and author of the book Ouija's World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Miles Barth, a curator at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan and author of a book about the photographer known as Ouija. You know, when Ouija was doing his tabloid photos, it's not like, well, he was photographing the Bowery and then he'd go home to his palace and unwind. He lived in this one-room apartment across the street from police headquarters, and there's actually a photo of it in your show. And, you know, it's there's like a bed, a desk, a floor, a ceiling, a light bulb. You know, it's really, it's not much of a home.
And you'll notice he's sleeping in his clothes.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
This was a trademark of his. He felt that, I don't know if you're looking at the same photo that I'm thinking of, but in that room, towards the top of the ceiling, he had actually strung wire across from the police station and hooked it up to a speaker so that when the alarms went off, it was actually going off in his room if he wasn't in his car. So he could literally hop out of bed, just throw his shoes on, and be out the door within a few seconds. So he really resented, you know, sleeping in pajamas. He liked to sleep in his clothes.
Which is probably one of the reasons why some of his colleagues complained about his personal hygiene.
Often and loudly, they complained. And some of the remaining colleagues that can remember how disgusting of a person he was were free to tell me this at their earliest convenience when I was doing the early research on the book and exhibition.
Ouija was a nickname. Spelled Weegee, which is different from the way the Ouija board is spelled. Ouija was a kind of fortune-telling game, spelled differently. People assume that Ouija's nickname came from the Ouija board. Is there any connection, or is there a different source for the nickname?
Well, the source of the nickname is more from the squeegee that he used in the darkrooms of the New York Times when he was drawing prints for the printers. It's just coincidence, maybe, that, you know, when Ouija started to go off on his own and make photographs at night and would bring them back and people would marvel at these, you know, wondrous images and how did you find them and how could you have possibly gotten there before the police or before the fire department, he would say that he was, you know, his powers of fortune-telling were very similar to those of the Ouija board. And I think there's a combination of reasons how he got that name, but it sort of stuck. And as he says in his autobiography, the spelling was purely my own.
How has your impressions of Ouija changed from the time before you started the exhibit to now?
Well, I think maybe they've changed by sensing that underneath the crust, this hardcore, cigar-smoking, brash, filthy, rough, crude, chauvinist pig that Ouija was. There was an Arthur Fellig who was an extremely sensitive, very emotional, someone who was very much shunned by women who I think for most of his life felt very sad about. I think he always wanted to have a relationship and some kind of normal life, which he never did. And I think there were these two people, and I've discovered the sensitivity of Arthur Fellig and how someone who was so sensitive and shy and almost introverted in some ways could create such an enormous alter ego, Ouija, that lived out the fantasies of what he really wanted to be, but probably couldn't do it without that disguise.
So you think of Ouija as being a disguise for Arthur Fellig?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it was a very ingenious, clever plot to advance himself in a career which he became extremely well known at. He is in almost every history of photography book that has anything to do with photojournalism or documentary photography. And I don't believe that mine is the last generation that will be able to discover him. I think he's going to be continuously rediscovered in the future. And I think other people will come along and do new books of his work, because it really almost stands alone in the period. There are a few photographers that really did as much as he did in such a short period of time, in such a, you know, an incredible city, you know, that existed in New York, you know, between the mid-1930s and 1940s.
Miles Barth, thanks so much for talking with us about the photographs of Ouija.
Thank you.
Miles Barth is the author of the book Ouija's World, which collects Ouija's photos. Barth also curated the exhibit Ouija's World, which originated at the International Center of Photography in Manhattan. It will tour Europe in the fall and America in the year 2000.